the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. I've just read an extraordinary book, the memoir Luck and Circumstance, A Coming of Age in Hollywood, New York, and Points Beyond, by Michael Lindsay Hogg. Michael Lindsay Hogg was always a familiar name to me because he is the director of a film I have seen many dozens of times over the last 40 years or so, namely Let It Be. He is the son of actress Geraldine Fitzgerald, and he has had great success as a director on British television, on film, and on the stage. His book is engrossing and beautifully written, and has a mystery of sorts at its center, because Michael Lindsay Hogg might be the son of Orson Welles. Michael Lindsay Hogg, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Gary, I'm delighted to be with you, talking about the book and talking to you.
Well, you know, when I first saw your name, Michael Lindsay Hogg, in the credits of Let It Be back in 1970, I was sitting at a theater on Hollywood Boulevard, I thought, why didn't he change his name? Why didn't you change your name?
Well, the Vogue Theater on Hollywood Boulevard.
That was it. Yes,
that was it. I didn't for a funny reason. I wanted to be an actor, and I thought the name Lindsay Hogg wouldn't be a good name for an actor. And so I was trying out, I was 16 years old, trying out other names in a pad I had up in my room. And the year before, my mother had been in a production of King Lear that Orson Welles was starring in and directing. And he'd very kindly let me go to rehearsal. My mother and Orson had worked together first at the Mercury Theater in the late 30s. And he was very nice to me, and I admired him so much because of everything, including, of course, Citizen Kane. And so I thought, well, Michael Welles might be a good name. It sounded good. And so I went down to talked to my mother, who was sitting having an after-dinner drink, and I said, what about Michael Welles? And she said, what for? And I said, for my stage name. And she said, well, what's wrong with the name you've got? And I said, well, it's a little unwieldy, isn't it? And then she said, I'm not sure that's a good idea, Michael Welles. And I said, well, why not? And she said, well, maybe I should have mentioned something to you about it before, but it didn't come up, and I didn't think it mattered. But the thing is that some people think that Orson and I had an affair and think that he's your father. And so that's why I didn't change my name. I mean, that's part of a longer story. But Michael Welles, my mother thought, wasn't a good idea because of all these rumors.
Was that the first time you ever heard the idea that you might be the son of Orson Welles?
Yeah, it was. And, I mean, my mother was, I loved her, still do. She died 5 years ago or so. She always brought me up to think that whatever she told me was the truth, which, as I wrote the book and found out more about her, seemed to be a very convenient upbringing for her ends, if not so much for mine. No, that was the first time I'd heard about it, and then over the years, since the little fire got kindled in the grate, I heard more about it, and there were more rumors and stuff, and it was, of course, interesting to me. My mother always denied it. She had a very funny habit of often bringing the subject up to people. Have you ever heard that people say that Orson is Michael's father? And then in the next sentence, deny it. It is, which many people have told me that, you know, they'd have lunch with her, like lady friends of hers, and she'd bring this up, and she'd say this, and then deny it, and they think, well, I wonder why she does that. That was the first I heard of it, and then over the years, I worked with Orson in the theater in a version of Chimes at Midnight, in which he played Falstaff. He went on to make a wonderful movie of it, and I had a wonderful time with him. He's very nice. He took me out for dinner most of the evenings. I think it's a long episode, which is in the book. I mean, it's good to read, but I think if I told you the whole 10 pages, you know, you'd be asleep or something like that. Or maybe you're still awake. But, yeah, it's the first I heard about it, and then over the years it kind of dogged me. But, you know, I let it go for a long time because I had my own life to live.
Well, do you think your life would have been different if you had been sure of your parentage in any way?
If he is my father... that's a very interesting question. If he is my father, I suppose to be the son, the acknowledged son from early on of someone who did great work themselves, I think probably is a burden. More, Jean Renoir was the son of Auguste Renoir, the director, the son of the painter, and they both did pretty well. there are so many stories and tales of the sons of the famous, famous men or famous women who found it burdensome and in some ways like a chain around their neck. Rather than propelling them forward, it held them back. But the thing is, it's hard to deal in speculation in a way. In other words, I am who I am, and how things have worked out are the way things have worked out. And I could think a little bit about it, but I think in a funny way, I suppose I'm glad that I only had me to deal with and not the chain around my neck.
Peter Bogdanovich, he's been a guest here on From the Bookshelf. Mm. And he was a great friend of yours when you were both young, and he went on to great success for a little bit in Hollywood. Mm. And at one time, Orson Welles lived with him. Mm. Were you jealous of his friendship with Orson Welles?
No, because I didn't know about it, because Peter and I were great friends in our teenage years. We met together in the Stratford Shakespeare Festival Theater, where we both were apprentices, which means unpaid actor, basically. And I was 16 and Peter was 17. And for the next several years, we talk on the phone every night. You know, we're still in high school, both in New York, going to school near each other. And rather than doing our homework, we talk about books and plays and girls, sort of the usual things guys talk about. In 1961, we both were going to direct in Summer Stock in Phoenicia, New York. And Polly Platt, extraordinarily talented woman who recently died, was our costume designer. And we both fell in love with her, and Peter got her. And that sort of got in the way of the friendship for quite a while, because I didn't like the way I'd found out about it. But, you know, when I was... So the friendship changed. Peter had his great success, but I was living in England then and doing whatever I was doing, which is working on television. And I wasn't tracking Peter, nor was I tracking Orson very much. And I didn't know until much later that they had become so close, and that Peter was not only, that Orson was not only staying with Peter, but Peter was trying to help him with film financing. This is at a time when Peter was able to do such a thing because of his own success and, you know, his own access to money and also to people in the studio who liked him. But I've always been, I suppose, blinkered in a way that I'm kind of after whatever it is I'm after, which is doing rock and roll or doing dramatic stuff. And I don't particularly notice what other people are doing, which may be a good thing, because I'm sure if I did notice it, I would be riven and eaten up by envy, which is something I'd like to avoid for as long as possible.
Well, of course, sure. I mean, I didn't ask, were you jealous of the Last Picture Show or something like that?
Well, no, but obviously I admired it. I mean, the one I like best is Paper Moon. Of those early three of Last Picture Show, What's Up, Doc, and Paper Moon, those early three movies are as strong a first three movies as any director has done, you know, in his early years, I think.
Maybe Paper Moon holds up the best of them.
I think so.
Yeah. Well, what Peter Biskin, in his book about 70s movies, he kind of accuses Bogdanovich of not being fair to Polly Platt, and that she had an equal... input into the making of Last Picture Show. Do you have any thoughts about that? I mean, since you knew.
Well, I wasn't there. I have thoughts that sometimes, if you're lucky enough as a director to have a collaborator who is probably every bit as bright as you are, with a slightly different sensibility, just because we're all different people, and in that case, Polly was a woman and Peter was a man. Sometimes. The value of that person cannot be overrated, because that person, especially if you're very close and maybe married like they were, that person has your ear at all times and also is able to influence you. And I think, since, yes, directing, you know, you're the auteur and all that stuff, but basically I've always thought of directing as being like a host at a dinner. And that you always want to bring out the best in your guests. And your guests could be the actors, the best could be your crew, the best could be your designers. But in order to do that, you have to know what they're thinking about things. And I believe very much in collaboration. So was Polly critical, crucial to Peter with those in that time? I would think she was very important.
Yeah. We're talking with Michael Lindsay Hogg, and he's written this great book. It's called Luck and Circumstance, and everybody should go get it right now and read it. And one of the things that you talk about in your book, I mean, when I was a kid, I used to dream how cool it would be to be a fly on the wall and watch the Beatles make a record. You know, that would be the greatest thing. And you're the main fly.
Main fly. Maybe I should have called the book Main Fly instead of Luck and Circumstance. Yeah, I got lucky at a certain point in my life. I'd always liked rock and roll. I guess my first rock and roll was Shaboom for the Chords in 1953, and then of course went on to Elvis and Little Richard, and then in the Beatles days. Because of a series of things which happened, and I was to do with it a lot. I was very ambitious. I was. I'd learned how to intrigue. I'd learned how to find out what was going on and how to maybe take advantage of that. When I was 24, I was having, you know, been an actor and been working previously in Irish television. When I was 24, I was working for an English television company, directing the best rock and roll show ever, which was called Ready, Steady, Go. Ready, Steady, Go was a live 45 minutes every Friday night, and the house bands, the bands who were on fairly regularly, were the Rolling Stones, the Who, the Kinks, the Animals, etc. The Beatles watched the show. They'd been on it before I'd taken it over, and they were admirers of it. Partly, I think, because I'd worked in the theater, I had to come up with different ways of lighting the bands and also shooting them. Because one of the things that the television shows at the time, the American versions would have been Shindig and Hullabaloo, what they were trying to do was contain the chaos that was rock and roll. And what we on Ready, Steady, Go tried to do was embrace the chaos. And the bands really liked being on it because not only was it live in the air, but we also, pretty quickly after I joined it, had live sound. So they didn't have to mime to the single. They could sing it and play on it, and also they could do whatever other songs they wanted. So it gave them more rooms, like the Rolling Stones would come on and do three or four songs on their special show.
And it would actually go out of the air as they were doing it?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, which sometimes was great. I mean, it was, you know... for me, it was wonderful because I had to be as on my toes as the musicians were, because I would have four, sometimes five cameras, and have to call the shots and set up the shots as it was happening. You know, I'd have to say, because what was going on, like the crowd might be rioting and we couldn't get the shot we wanted, so I'd have to go to the other camera, give me the close-up of Mick, and give me the three shot, which includes Keith, and then we cut between them. So it was enormously full of adrenaline for me and a lot of fun. I met the Beatles. We did the first videos, which were then called promos, like in promotional films, where Paperback Writer and Rain. Then a couple of years later, after I'd done the Stones' first video, which was Jumping Jack Flash, the Beatles asked me to do Revolution and Hey Jude. This is coming up here, Fly in the Wall.
Yeah.
When we shot Hey Jude, Paul and I, a few days before, thought that even with the Beatles being the people you were looking at, we needed something to go with the four-minute closing chorus. Because just to keep shooting Paul and George and John and Ringo with da-da-da-da-da-da-da, wasn't enough. So we decided we'd get a crowd, and it wasn't going to be just, you know, the fan club crowd. It would be a mixture of housewives and the village postman and young people and old people, and they would be the chorus at the end. We were shooting it on videotape, which in those days was a more cumbersome thing than what people shoot on these days. And after every take, to make sure that it wouldn't run too long, we'd have to reload the video reels. We'd sort of put up a virgin reel, and the cameraman would get notes and reposition. So there'd be about a 10-minute delay between each take of Hey Jude. And the first 10-minute delay, the Beatles just sort of stood there smoking and chewing gum. But the second delay, 10 minutes or so, they thought, there are people here and we're here. And then all those instincts from the time they were 15 into Hamburg came, and they started to play, you know, old Pamela Motown songs, old Beatles songs. And by the time, they were kind of reluctant at first and kind of pissed off because they didn't really want to be playing for anyone again. They'd stopped playing in public in 1966, and this was August 1968. But after the sixth break, they were really kind of enjoying it. And, of course, the audience was in heaven. I mean, to be 100 people, to be basically getting a free Beatles concert was something that they hadn't expected when they'd, you know, been lured out to where we were shooting that day. As a result of their experience playing to these 100 or so people, they thought it might be possible for them to do a television special. Because Paul most, George Least, and then the other sort of in between, wanted them to get themselves out there again. Paul didn't only want to go to the studio, which George did. So they started to talk to me because they'd like the videos. They'd like Hey Jude and Revolution and Paperback Writer and Rain Before about doing a television special with them. And we had the idea that as well as trying to figure out what the television special would be, we would have a couple of cameras in and shoot the Beatles as they were rehearsing. As the idea was that that would be like a teaser, like a half hour the week before the big television special extravaganza. And so we started to shoot, but as time went on, there was a sense that they were fracturing rather than gluing together. And then what happened is I had an idea for a television special, which would take place, it would take place in an amphitheater in Tunisia by the coast of the Mediterranean. It wasn't so much that bit I liked. It was this old premises, as it were, and the stones would be, you know, beveled from 1,000 years of sand going across them. And then the Beatles would set up at dawn, and then the music would go out over the desert. And then, as though people were going to a Noah's Ark, they would come on foot, mothers with children, men, jeeps, whatever. And so by nightfall, the stadium, the amphitheater, would be full of the world, was the idea. So by the time we got to Long and Winding Road or or Let It Be, the combination of music and people would be sort of beautiful, was my plan. But that didn't work because George didn't want to do it. He wanted to go back in the studio, which is what happened. We left the film studio. We went into their small studio in Apple to go on. But then I realized that something else was maybe good here, which was that no one had ever filmed the Beatles rehearsing. This is going back to your main fly.
Yeah.
No one had ever filmed them rehearsing. I mean, they were the Beatles. You know, it was like watching, I mean, actually people did watch Picasso paint. I mean, there's that wonderful...
Right, The Magic of Picasso.
Yeah, and so people did watch him paint, and sometimes other artists have been observed or filmed doing their prep work, the stuff that goes into what's going to be finished. But with the Beatles, of course, was different, because if you're rehearsing music, you're not only playing music, you're talking about it, you're having a spat, you're saying this is going well, whatever. So I realized we actually... we're shooting something which could be wonderful and also historic with these people. So that's how I got to be the main fly from my show Ready, Steady, Go, from doing some videos with them, from them liking the videos, and then maybe wanting to do this other thing with me. And so even though we didn't do the special, you have the film Let It Be, which ends with the Great Roof Concert. And the reason that was great is it actually was their goodbye. It was the last time they ever played in front of or to any kind of audience. And they did other studio work, but that was it. And, you know, there's so many kind of concerts where you hear it's the goodbye concert or it's the last...
farewell.
Last farewell. And they're not. This was the last time they did it, and we didn't know it. And since we didn't know it was going to be historic in its way, there was no pressure on it except, you know, to get the cameras in the right place and shoot it. And the thing which is so great for when someone sees Let It Be Again is they were happy up there in the roof. They weren't happy in the studios, and they broke up, what, a year later. But up there on that cold day in January, they really rocked and rolled like they had before, and all the fissures in their relationship were forgotten, and they just were a rock and roll band having a good time. And so that's a very beautiful thing to see in the movie.
Well, Michael Lindsay-Hogg, in Luck and Circumstance, your book, you talk about a lot of stuff that you liked that was edited out of Let It Be. Can you give us an idea of what was cut?
Yeah, we had a screening of the rough cut. Rough cuts, which, as you know, are always longer than it ends up, but there are sometimes things in the rough cut which you want to keep. I mean, often a lot of it. And it was the night before Neil Armstrong landed on the moon, because I remember when I went home after the screening and I had dinner with Paul and John and Yoko and Linda and my girlfriend Jean Marsh. We watched him go on, at dawn, we watched him put his foot on the moon. Then the next morning, I got a call from Peter Brown, who was one of the guys, one of the original eight or nine who came from Liverpool, and saying he thought it had gone well, but that he thought that some of the stuff about John, with John and Yoko, should be edited out. And I said, I really like that stuff. And he said, well, let me put it this way. I've had 3 phone calls this morning saying that some of the stuff about John and Yoko should be cut.
One from Paul, one from George.
I don't know. 3 phone calls. Make of that what you will. And so we did cut some of it out. It was an interesting experience because, of course, they were the stars of the picture, but they also were the producers of the picture. So anything which was at all off the party line, as it were, I had to sneak in there because I thought, they wanted it. They wanted a lot of music in it because, it's a music picture. And also they had a picture they had to give to United Artists as their last picture in their deal. But I was trying to get as much of the conversation and a sense of the relationships as I could. And so there's a lot of good stuff, and who knows what's going to happen.
Yeah, can't you call Sir Paul and prevail upon him to put out a director's cut Blu-ray with?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think they marched their own drum, yeah. Which is a collective drum, not only played by Ringo, but I think there probably is a plan for Let It Be to come out at some point in the next X number of X's. And maybe with it, what would be great is if there's a companion DVD about the making of it.
Which you would love to do.
It's sort of been mooted, if that's the word.
Uh-huh, yeah. Well, you also did a fabulous film that was, held back for years and years, but now we've seen it and enjoyed it, and that's the Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Circus. And in your book, you talk about Mick and Keith as being, pretty complex characters. Can you sort of contrast Jagger and Richards with Lennon and McCartney?
That's an interesting question. I mean, let me think how I can do that. Certainly the similarities are very close in that they both sets of men knew each other when they were very young. McCartney and Lennon, I think, were 15 and 16. And I think Mick and Keith met when they were 7 or 8 or 9 and then dropped out of each other's life and then came into each other's life again. I don't know, when they're 14 or 15. So the friendship goes back a long time. I think about Mick and Keith is in their best collaboration is they mix male and female, alpha and beta. I don't know if beta is the mix of the contrast of alpha, in a sort of perfectly synchronized way, in that Keith is very butch in a way, and Mick is very feline in a way. But yet when you put them together, they become this extraordinary ball of seduction and aggression. And I would say that is, and also you could have Keith being tender and Mick being aggressive. But I think that's quite good, which is aggression and seduction. And that is to do with their two characters and how, and also how things change. I mean, like going back to an earlier conversation, you know, I was friendly with Bogdanovich and then it changes. One of the things as you go through life is that the dominant character of a duo, let's say, will be dominant for X number of years, and then something will happen, and the other one will become the dominant character. Certainly, when Keith was having his deepest visits into the world of drugs, Mick really kept the Rolling Stones going, and actually was the one who would actually show up and do the mixes and do the overdubs and everything like that. Mick is oddly very, very responsible person, too. And so he did keep them going. How the contrast? I think they are separate, but when they get together as musicians and collaborators and creators, they're better together, I think, than they are apart. And I think that's the same of Paul and John. Although Paul has done some wonderful stuff on his own, but together they were unbeatable. Like together, Mick and Keith are unbeatable.
Well,
is that a kind of answer?
Yeah, it was definitely an answer. I would say so. Yes.
I mean, one of the funny things I noticed about the Rolling Stones, who I really love, is that we saw them on a tour 3-4 years ago, and they're just as great on stage as they've always been. It's amazing, Mick, at what his age then was, 65 or something.
Yeah.
He's always had the body of a marathon runner and the brains and kind of entertainment skill of someone from another planet, but there was no context to what they were doing. They were doing the songs. They're doing the songs who were great, but when it was in the 60s, and like say 1968, when there were riots in France and in America, there was the war protest movement, is that rock and roll not only was affecting the culture and fashion and music, but it was almost affecting the very fabric of society, which was the context of the 1960s and all that was going on. Whereas now, everything is different, and these rebels have become sort of the establishment. So it's very odd to see them in a different context, and the context doesn't perhaps suit them as well as the original context.
Yeah, well, times have changed, haven't they?
They sure have.
Well, this book, Luck and Circumstance, A Coming of Age in Hollywood, New York, and Points Beyond by Michael Lindsay Hogg. It's just a great book. I loved it. I was just so absorbed by it. And it's about so many other things, although it's also about the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. So I thank you for spending some time talking about those things today. But maybe you'll come back again and we can get into some of the other things.
Yeah, because the way you've talked about the book, I sense that it did affect you and you did get it. It's also about, I mean, there is all the rock and roll stuff, which is great, and Brideshead Revisited in theater and stuff like that. But it also is about my family and me. And like with any family, it's about connections which were made and connections which were missed. And so there is a kind of poignancy to the book, as well as all the kind of glittery, wonderful stories. And then there is the mystery, which as the book goes on, it does sort of turn into a mystery story about who is the father of the author.
And of course, that person, Orson Welles, looms large.
Looms large in every sense. He loomed large.
Yes, yes. Well, Michael Lindsay Hogg, then you will come back and talk.
I'd love to, Gary, anytime. I've really enjoyed this because you let me jabber on for a while, and then when I finish, you always had the right follow-up question.
Well, thank you.
I enjoyed it very much.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the show and that you'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org or find us on Facebook and iTunes. From the Bookshelf, production assistance is provided by Francis Venegas. Thanks, Francis. I want to thank my guest, Michael Lindsay Hogg. His book is called Luck and Circumstance, A Coming of Age in Hollywood, New York, and Points Beyond. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.